From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we learn about a new exhibit at Jewish Museum Milwaukee that explores the life of a young woman growing up in the Łódź ghetto. Then, why Harry Windsor and Meghan Markle leaving behind their royal duties may have bigger implications about race relations in the UK.
I hope that this is going to shine a light on the way race and racism are embedded and operate in British culture in ways that are often not acknowledged.
And the first innovator in residence at Marquette University says creating useful products and ideas is more widespread than you might think.
Innovation's happening all the time. So much we think of it as a tech sector thing. Innovation happens in nonprofits. It happens in just about every industry. The people that survive, it's happened in radio, right? If you don't innovate, you're not relevant anymore. And honestly, it's happening in higher education.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Bonnie North. 75 years ago this month, the Auschwitz concentration camp in Poland was liberated by the Russian army. The days that followed were filled with chaos as the liberators grappled with how to care for those still alive in the camp. There were warehouses full of things stolen from those interred at the camp, like shoes and glasses and other personal items. And somewhere in all of that turmoil, there was a small schoolbook, a diary belonging to Rivka Lipschitz from the Łódź ghetto. The notebook passed through many hands before landing at the Galicia Jewish Museum in Krakow, Poland, where it inspired an exhibit, The Girl in the Diary. The exhibit is making its U.S. public premiere tomorrow at Jewish Museum Milwaukee. Molly Dubin is the curator of the exhibit at the museum, and Jakub Nowakowski is the director of the Galicia Jewish Museum. They joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the discovery of the diary and investigating the story behind it.
Rivka was a Jewish girl born in the Polish city of Łódź. She was born in 1929 in the Orthodox Jewish family, and she lived her life in Łódź. Things has changed during the war. And to make long story shorter, at some point in 1945, actually right after the liberation of the Auschwitz Birkenau camp, just around we are just about to celebrate the 75th anniversary. So 75 years ago, a diary of Rivka Lipschitz is being discovered in the ruins of Auschwitz. So the question is, what happened with Rivka? How the diary ended up in Auschwitz? What happened with her outer after Auschwitz? These are all questions that were asked, and some of the answers will be given at the museum in the exhibition.
As you kind of allude to here, the title of the exhibit is Searching for Rivka in the Łódź Ghetto. What does the term searching in the title, what does that really mean in this context?
I think it's got two meanings. There's certainly a physical meaning in terms of wanting to physically find out what Rivka's fate was, but it's also about finding out who Rivka was in terms of her identity. And getting an inkling of that through her writings in the diary. That's one of the things that is so incredible about having discovered this notebook, which, you know, because of how it was found and being passed down, you know, to several individuals before it was eventually brought to Jewish Family and Children's Services in San Francisco, where it was authenticated and began to be translated. It starts to reveal not only a documentation of a period of time within the Łódź ghetto that we had very few voices speaking to before, but also it's very much a coming-of-age story set against a backdrop of atrocity. So it's this very fascinating combination of giving you a glimpse into what daily life was like, the hardships, everything that was suffered in terms of the limited resources, the hunger, the fact that the Łódź ghetto was made into this huge slave labor camp. All of those things come through in the diary. But, you know, above all else is really this incredible voice who is seemingly coming out of, you know, the dark from decades previously that we never knew we would have the chance to hear from. So to hear her talk about being in the ghetto, but also the things that she's experiencing in terms of wanting to find love, you know, what does it mean to find love? Who do I have relationships with? The importance of my relationships with my friends here or with my cousins who she wound up needing to live with because both of her parents perished. So you have all this kind of teenage angst, if you will, that you would expect from that time period, that juxtaposed with the narrative of this taking place in a ghetto at a horrifying, unimaginable time is just a compelling insight. And we hope it will really engage people on many levels.
You know, I think many people are familiar with the diary of Anne Frank, another young woman
right.
living through the Holocaust. And diaries and these kinds of very personal takes on what happened at that time have become so integral to our understanding of that time period. Why are things like diaries so important for our understanding of the Holocaust and the many events that happened around it?
The diaries are allowing us to narrow the point of view. I mean, we know lots about the big events of the Second World War. We know about the German policy toward the Jews of Łódź and about the context of Rivka's situation. What is missing in those big documents, those big data that we have, is the emotions, the feeling, the daily decisions that are lost. And the diaries are allowing us to get a grasp of those very the moments that are, you know, gone with the wind otherwise. So I think that what makes the diaries so powerful, because they are often written in the first person. Sometimes they, with Rivka's diary, they were not meant to be published. Rivka is addressing her diary directly. My dear diary, I had working classes today and so on and so on. Rivka doesn't think about this as a publication. That's for her actually. This entire writing started as a practice. It was a homework for one of her teachers, perhaps also as some kind of attempt to mentally help the students, the young kids, to cope with the tragedy that is happening around them. The emotions that we are able to understand because we do feel them in our daily life. I mean, Molly said this hunger for being appreciated, the feeling of being alone, fear. These are things that we can relate to, of course, despite many changes and many differences in our situation. But these are things that connect us through the time and through the different situations rather than divide.
You know, just expanding on what Jacob said, it's that idea of the personal dimension. So often when you are educating about the Holocaust or sharing narratives about the Holocaust, especially for younger generations, it's hard for them to wrap their heads around this vast idea of 6 million lives lost and all the contributions to the world that were extinguished with those lives. And it's the personal stories that get lost, unfortunately, a lot of times in trying to understand the enormity of the atrocity. So to have those personal dimensions, as Jacob said, allows us, you know, in contemporary society, today's day and date, here we are, you know, reflecting 75 years later, we're able to connect to Rivka. We've experienced some of those same emotions and some of those same worries and challenges. And also, as Jacob said, the diary really kind of took everything. It was her friend, her confidant, her support. It was a means of catharsis. It was everything that I'm afraid to say or cannot say. I'm going to pour into these pages. Certainly, there was no thought that this was going to be published. So it's just brutally honest. And I think that is also what helps us to make that direct connection to her.
You know, you mentioned that Rivka's diary was one of few personal documents about the Łódź ghetto. What were some of the things that her diary really illuminated about daily life in Łódź?
The Łódź ghetto is pretty well documented. I mean, we know about the German policy. We know about its leadership. Rivka is at the very, very end of the food chain. She, in her diary, she writes nothing about, you know, the big things of the war. She doesn't write about Chaim Rumkowski, the head of the ghetto. She is only a receiver of those comments, of those situations. So it allows us to understand what was the reaction of the very common, simple person to those big things. I mean, when we know from our perspective what is happening on that day. She is absolutely unaware of the things, of the preparations to deportation. She's unaware of why certain things are happening. She helps us to understand what was the reaction of the people, why people were not seeing what we think was obvious. We know how the story ends. Rivka and many millions and so many other victims couldn't have seen what is coming because it never happened in the history before. It's also allowing us to understand are the networks that were created by regular people that were created in order to help each other, to support each other. Rivka's diary is very special, and Rivka was special because she was coming out of the Orthodox family, which means she lives among women and among girls. Men in that diary are mentioned, her father, her brother, some teachers, but they are in the context. So that's something that is very unusual, because when we're reading about the war and diaries of the war, many of them are coming from men, are about men. Rivka's diary is about women. She lives with the women, she lives among the women, her friends and colleagues are women. She feels uncomfortable when there is a boy coming, you know, for a class. And that makes it very, very unusual, because we don't have this kind of voices coming out of the Orthodox Jewish women that survived. What makes this story even more unusual or more powerful is that actually the woman's story that does not end in Auschwitz. You know, the Rivka diary was found by a Russian women doctor in January 1945, then passed on, as Molly said, to other people. And 7 years later, 6 years later, it is granddaughter of Zinaida, Anastasia, that brings the diary to the States. And in the States, these are another women, like Dr. Anita Friedman and her colleagues in San Francisco, that are undertaking the task of translating the diary and so on. So we have an entire chain of women that reacted, that made some decisions and allowed us to understand this story, which we think is very powerful. And when we created this exhibition back in Krakow, we decided to honor this special relation. And the exhibition, the text of Rivka's diary is expanded with the comments of experts, because Rivka doesn't explain us why she's hungry, why she's starving, what happens. So we have experts, historians, psychologists, rabbis that are helping us to understand what she is reacting to. And all of them are also women. We wanted to honor this reality of Rivka's world that was world of women. We didn't want her to feel uncomfortable in this very symbolic way. And I think, again, that's something that makes this entire story very special and important today.
We should clarify, you know, there certainly are diaries of young people that have been recovered. But as Jacob said, the majority are male voices. Of course, as you mentioned earlier, we think of Anne Frank when we think about the female voices. But the fact that she is Orthodox and the point of view that she's coming from, the existence that she's coming from, the fact that her belief and faith and traditions are a guiding force, really, in her survival. She struggles with needing to work on the Sabbath or on a high holiday because those are against her religion and her traditions. But it's also a saving grace for her, I think, that structure and that just honest, sincere faith that wavers occasionally. You hear the moments of doubt occasionally, but it's her faith that is also a huge sustaining factor.
So when people go to this exhibit, what should they expect to see?
They'll see a story of a girl that did nothing wrong, and that did everything she could to stay alive, that went through unimaginable, horrible evil, and did not lose hope. I mean, whether you're Jewish or Catholic or Muslim, this question of how to cope with the tragedy, the question of how, where's God in the moment of crisis, this teenager girl is giving us the answer. I mean, the God is in us. We are carrying the God in our hearts. And that's something that will be this universal lesson for all of us. But of course, the exhibition will give us also the context. We need to understand why Rivka is where she is, what happens, what brought her, and what happened later on. So the exhibition will also give us this historical context, will show us objects, original objects coming from United States Holocaust Memorial Museum and coming from Jewish Historical Institute in Warsaw, objects coming from Łódź ghetto, that will be on display, and the photographs. I think one of the most important aspects of this exhibition are also the photographs. And when usually we learn or we teach about the Holocaust, we often use the photographs that came out of the German photographers. They are presenting us the Jews in a way the Germans wanted them us to see. So we see people working or just about to being shot. We see dead bodies. We see people in, you know, skeletons. We don't see people that we can relate to. What we put together is a collection of photographs that are showing the actual living figures, people that are within the ghetto, that are living just, you know, a few months or weeks before being sent to gas chambers in Auschwitz or Chełmno. But they are still holding to the things that make them human. They still are able to love, and they are still able to cherish the daily small things. I think that's what makes this set of photographs very unusual, because they are showing us the living human beings, something that is easy to forget when we look at those Nazi photographs.
Absolutely. And the Galicia did such an incredible job of really developing this exhibit and compartmentalizing it to understand the narrative. So you really have an introductory section that speaks to life in the Łódź ghetto, the establishment of the ghetto. There are facsimiles of newspaper articles, of documents that are showing the establishment and, you know, the rights that are being stripped from the Jewish community. And then we move to the central component, which our changing exhibit gallery has been completely converted into a dark room, where there is a central interactive table with excerpts from the diary, commentary by scholars, rabbis, psychiatrists, as Jacob mentioned. There are artifacts from the ghetto. So you have that as the central piece. And then projected on the image, on the walls all around the gallery, are pictures of life in the Łódź ghetto. So you have three photographers, two who were Jewish and had photographic experience prior to being imprisoned. And we know the Nazis always like to kind of find out what kind of skill was available to them and to utilize it. So those two were really tasked with not only photographing for identification cards, documentation, but because of their role and their position, they were able to clandestinely take photographs as well, showing the Jewish community. And then the third photographer was a Nazi who was the head accountant of the ghetto. His feelings much more have that kind of documentary feel that Jacob alluded to, of Jews as really just kind of objects within a composition versus showing the life and what is going on in that community behind those walls. So that juxtaposition of those images with artifacts that have been pulled out of the rubble of crematoriums and these words that are coming to us decades later, it is incredibly powerful. And then the last component is really looking at the discovery of the diary, its authentication, and the research that happened following its discovery, and some really surprising things that came to light, that there was one thought about Rivka's fate, and now there are documents that have come to light that give us pause, and we are still wondering what the ultimate fate of Rivka's life was. So all three of those together, the documents, the photographs, the artifacts, all of these things combine for what we really think is an incredibly powerful and resonant experience.
Yeah. Well, Molly, Jakob, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Molly Dubin is the curator of programs at Jewish Museum Milwaukee, and Jakub Nowakowski is the director of the Galicia Jewish Museum in Kraków, Poland. They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about the Girl in the Diary exhibit at Jewish Museum Milwaukee. It opens to the public tomorrow. There's more information about it at WUWM.com. Coming Coming up after a break, why Harry Windsor and Meghan Markle leaving behind their royal duties may have bigger implications about race relations in the UK. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. When Meghan Markle and Harry Windsor revealed earlier this month that they would be stepping back from their duties as part of the British royal family, it sent shockwaves throughout the UK and the US. Many questioned their decision, wondered how the couple would make their own money, and what exactly stepping back means. But what isn't getting as much attention here is the role the media might have played in the couple's decision. Since Markle, a biracial woman, first began a relationship with the royal family, the British media's portrayal of her, particularly in the tabloid press, has been less than flattering, especially when compared to the kind of coverage her sister-in-law, Kate Middleton, receives. Nat Godley is an assistant professor of history at Alverno College. He focuses on race and ethnicity in Europe. He's a white British man who grew up with a black British sister and has a black son. Godley spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell about what the Duke and Duchess of Sussex were facing.
Well, the British media, and particularly the tabloid newspapers, are something that I think we don't really have an equivalent of in the U.S. The biggest selling newspaper in the U.K. is called The Sun. It's a tabloid newspaper, and in the U.K., tabloid means a lot of very sensationalist coverage, a lot of royal coverage, a lot of celebrity coverage, pretty poor coverage, I would say, of news, of what we'd generally think of as news, and you know, a lot of really kind of scurrilous gossip type stuff. And so the royals have long had to deal with this. It's certainly something that Harry actually has mentioned as affecting his mother's life and causing her death, basically. And so that's already a fact of life for the royals. However, there's generally been, and I think maybe especially since Diana's death, a degree of some respect for the royals' privacy. Not being too attacking of them. But I think that that changed with coverage of Meghan and Harry, that there was a lot more critical criticism of their life decisions. And so now that it has kind of come to a head and they have, as a couple, responded strongly to it, saying basically it's driven them away from their position and from their country, that there's an analysis of why did that happen and what role did the fact that she is the first person of color to be officially a member of the royal family play in it. So.
And I'm looking here at a couple of examples of that coverage of Meghan, at least compared to her sister-in-law, Kate Middleton. BuzzFeed put together a side-by-side comparison of some of the headlines of Kate and Meghan, like doing the same type of activities, how they dress, etc. And so, for example, these two headlines from DailyMail.com, they show pictures of both Kate and Meghan holding their baby bumps. And the headline for Kate says, "Not long to go, pregnant Kate tenderly cradles her baby bump while wrapping up her royal duties ahead of maternity leave, and William confirms she's due any minute now." The headline for Meghan says, "Why can't Meghan Markle keep her hands off her bump? Experts tackle the question that has got the nation talking. Is it pride, vanity, acting, or a new age bonding technique?" Now, those examples were of some of the lighter coverage of them, but you could still see just how the smallest things, how they would critique Meghan so heavily. Was the British press ready for a woman of color to be in the royal family?
Yeah, I don't think that the British press, particularly this kind of sensationalist tabloid press that does most of the royal coverage, were ready for a woman who was as assertive as Meghan is, even though Kate had been assertive, Diana had been assertive, but Meghan was maybe a little more assertive, but then compounded by the fact that she is
a woman of color,
mm-hmm. A woman of a different citizenship, etc. But yeah, again, especially a woman of color, that kind of opened up to more criticism and kind of laid out some of the kind of deeper attitudes about race in British culture.
So what are the attitudes about race in the UK compared to race and racism here in America?
I think in general, in urban centers where populations of color tend to be concentrated, there's going to be a greater awareness of race and racism among the general population, including the white British population. And maybe that does also mean that in areas where there are smaller populations of color or more recently arrived populations of color where people are still dealing with the transformations of demographic change and getting used to their communities maybe looking different to in their parents' and grandparents' day, that there you may see more overt expression of racism. Sadly, I think that as in the U.S., you're going to see overt expressions of racism almost anywhere. And you're going to see the covert and sometimes even more damaging expressions of racism anywhere as well. But generally speaking, there's going to be more overt acknowledgement of it, more complex understanding of how racism works in areas where you've got larger and longer established populations of color, like London certainly, but also Manchester, Birmingham, places where populations are large and populations of color are large and long established enough that they've really become kind of organic parts of the fabric of those communities.
So to go back, when you said in areas where there are small populations of color or more recently arrived populations of color, racism is more likely to rear its ugly head because people are getting used to those changing demographics. How does that concept of new arrivals affect people's interactions? Because if people are thinking that populations of color are always new arrivals, I can only imagine the go back to where you came from mantra also comes up.
So in the classic example of the insult, go back to where you came from, my sister is Black British, born 20 miles away from where I was born, two parents who were also born in the UK, but were of Afro-Jamaican descent. And she was told, many times I heard her get told, go back to where you came from when we were kids. And, you know, obviously that was traumatic for her, horrendously traumatic for her. And it really made no sense. It's like, should I go back to Bedford? You know, which is, I do remember one time my a kid said that to her, and my mom marched around to his house. We knew where he lived. Marched around to his house and confronted him. Told his parents, and his mom, called him downstairs, clipped him around the ear, and said, "You were born in Scotland. She was born 20 miles away. You don't get to say that." But you know, that's kind of a rare thing. You know, that there is still this, even with long established populations like the Afro-Caribbean population, which is the earliest kind of large population of color to arrive in the mid-20th century, and which now is, you know, four or five generations in, that they still get told, go back to where you came from. And they literally have been recently sent back to, quote, where they supposedly came from because of some loopholes in nationality law that meant that some of them who were either immigrated as children or who were born to those who immigrated as children don't actually have British nationality. And some of them have even been deported in recent years under some pretty harsh immigration laws.
So to bring it back to Meghan and Harry, and how the media's coverage of them and critique of Meghan might be a factor as to why they made the decision to step back from their royal duties, it seems like this situation further highlights, at least to me, how the British media perpetuates racism. So if it is, in fact, due in part to how the media treated them, what impact do you hope this entire situation has in the UK?
I hope that this is going to shine a light on the way race and racism are embedded and operate in British culture in ways that are often not acknowledged, and that it will kind of, it has certainly started a conversation which is ongoing. I just saw on social media from a show called Question Time, which is a kind of panel discussion. They have a range of panelists from different political perspectives and then questions from the audience. Somebody brought this up, that this is an instance of race playing a role and discrimination against a woman of color playing a role in this. And just this pushback from one of the panelists, a white male actor, was just complete denial that this could possibly have been part of it. That, oh no, this is all just to do with Meghan's own behavior. That they're getting this criticism, and it's nothing to do with her race. And, the story is comparing her, the coverage of her behavior with coverage of equivalent behavior by Kate Middleton, her sister-in-law. Really suggest that there's something else going on when they're covered so differently for doing the same thing.
Support for Race and Ethnicity Reporting is provided by the Doman Company Foundation.
Nat Godley is an assistant professor of history at Alverno College. He spoke with WUWM's Taryn Powell. We will take one last break and then meet Marquette's first innovator in residence. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. If you use energy-efficient LED light bulbs in your home, you partly have Chuck Svoboda to thank. He spent 16 years as chief executive officer of Cree Incorporated, a company that helped bring LED lighting to the market. Svoboda says he's not done exploring innovation. He recently became Marquette University's first innovator in residence. He has a book coming out titled The Innovator Spirit, and he has a podcast at Marquette called Innovators on Tap. We wanted to know more, so we asked WUWM's innovation reporter Chuck Kornbach to talk with Svoboda. He began by shedding some light on how LED bulbs began.
You know, Cree was around for a long time before we made LED lighting a reality. When I started, it was a small startup, about $6 million in revenue, 30 people, and it would grow to $1.6 billion. But at one point, we knew we had an LED that we thought could make a light bulb, but no one was doing it. And we had actually planned to just sell the LEDs to the light bulb companies and let them make this happen. And after a couple of years of being really frustrated, a scientist showed up in my office one day and he said, I know you said not to work on this, but I did it anyways. I'm sick of waiting. And he shows me a prototype of an LED light bulb. And when I look at it, I realize we got to do this because you could just get it, right? You looked at it and go, that's what it's supposed to look like. And the big innovation was actually that he made it look like a regular light bulb. You know, so often we think of technology as this really complicated thing. He had simplified it. It looked like a light bulb. It worked just like a light bulb. And when you screwed it in, it worked with your dimmer. It did all the things people expected. And that was kind of an aha for me, that so often we think of innovation as this really complicated idea. And no, it's actually simplifying it so that the customer just gets it.
Some executives might have said, how dare you have worked on that on probably on company time or off company time and said, we're squelching this. Why did you go ahead?
Well, the company was started by five founders. It was built on innovation, right? It was the culture. It was the mindset of the employees. As much as, you know, management might say do this or do that, they were more motivated to do the right thing. And I think, you know, the ultimate purpose of what we did every day is solve hard problems. That's what motivated people. And when you see someone come in with a great idea, that's what we were there for, right? That's what makes companies great, or great ideas, not what you said to do or not said to do.
Other managers go along with it. I mean, sometimes it takes a whole company to accept an idea, not just the top person, but that wasn't necessarily the case at Cree, is that right?
Right. So at the time, Cree's about a $1 billion company. We actually make commercial lighting fixtures, but there's really nothing for the consumer. And when I saw it, one of the things we realized was the company, the larger company we had built, they could easily kill this idea. With all the process and all the rules and regulations and things that we did to make a product, this was an idea that really needed a much more innovative and creative approach. So when I saw it, we decided we were going to do it, but not tell anyone else. So literally, we took a team of 5 people led by one of the former founders of the company. He went and rented a warehouse, no name on the door, and they basically disappeared and started working on this in secret. And it took them about 12 months to invent it, to convince a customer, the Home Depot, to put it in all their stores, and to build a factory to make it. And we released it, I think it was about March I saw it for the first time. The following March is when we released it to the market, and probably less than 10 or 15 employees in the company knew the product existed the day we launched it.
Do you think that's typical innovation at companies, or is it more often the case that everyone's on board from day one?
I think what most companies try to do is bring everyone on board. But if you look at where do the big innovations come from, there's a reason startups work. Small teams focused on the problem. There's only one opportunity for success, right? There's no backup plan. They have to make it successful. How people think, how they're motivated, their incentives, that's a huge part of what makes innovation work. And so I think what happens is that in a large company, you try to replicate and scale that, and you're actually fighting human nature. You're fighting the people that you've hired to manage the business and run it and keep things under control and, hey, put this process in place so it's the same thing every time. I mean, think about innovation. You're trying to do something that's never been done before. How do you use a process to do something that's never been done? You can't. And so I think what we were trying to do is recreate that startup environment inside a larger company. And I think that's honestly, that's one of the big challenges for most companies today when it comes to innovation. And you know, that's what one of the things I'm working on now is how do you do it if you're in a larger company?
And you were an engineering graduate at Marquette. Did that help be more on the side of innovation as opposed to bean counting, if you will?
I think being an engineer helps in a lot of different ways. Part of it is, you know, an engineering degree, to some respect, feels like they're making you sit there for 4 years and just solve problems over and over, whether they're real-world problems or not. But it's that idea of seeing a problem, let's figure it out, and there's got to be a way to get to the goal. And I think that mindset was really helpful, and it helped me relate. I was not, you know, I worked with some of the most brilliant scientists in the world who helped develop the different products at Cree, but I could relate to their problem. And so they thought of me as the business guy, not as the engineer. But being an engineer, I think, made it easier for me to relate to their plight and help kind of guide things along.
You've talked about in your literature embracing risk and challenging the status quo. How important are those?
So one of the problems we have when it comes to innovation is that most of us are trained our whole lives to actually manage risk. In fact, an employee of mine one time described it as their whole career was manage or limit risk and deliver predictable outcomes. That's success. Well, if you want to pursue innovation, it's a function of the risk. It's kind of like, you know, you've seen those old charts from when you go to meet your investment advisor. How much return do you want? It's a function of risk. If you want to innovate, you have to take a lot of risk. It just doesn't work otherwise. And so I think it's a core principle of doing this. And as much as people say they want to do it, we're actually trained not to. So it's really critical to kind of get at that mindset.
There must be some criteria within that embracing risk. Is that right?
Yes and no. But I think the criteria are less formalized than you might think. The way we like to try to think about it is we're going to focus on things where we think we can solve a problem and create value. So often what we talk about when it comes to innovation is it's just new. New's part of it. But that problem solving and creating value, that's the hard part. So when we're going to take risk, we're going to take risk with the idea that do we really think it solves this problem and creates value. So the areas you're willing to take risk on are all to probe that idea. And what happens is you're going to try a lot of stuff that doesn't work.
So many of us are trained to try to find the right answer. And we're not trying to fail when we're doing that, but you're not afraid of it. Because what you realize is by trying something, whether you get a right answer or a wrong answer, you've learned something and you've gained knowledge. And at the end of the day, innovation is really about learning because you have no idea really how to solve the problem when you start. You have an idea, you kind of want to be directionally correct, but then you start trying things and you have to be willing to learn. And I think it's really critical if you're trying to be perfect, you'll never try the things you need to learn. And if you're afraid of what goes wrong, you're going to stop yourself before you test the really tough ideas. And so when we were taking ideas, if everyone liked it, it probably wasn't the right idea. You want to find something where some people like it and other people are uncomfortable. That's when you know you're probably on the right edge of that.
So with what you've learned in the private sector, you're now in the role at Marquette of the first ever innovator in residence. What does that title mean to you?
So it started out as a way to simply just, how did we do what we did at Cree? And how do we share this? And, you know, be honest, when they first asked me, I said, I don't know. We just did it. Like, it wasn't something I went in and thought about every day. So I spent the last couple of years in that role really trying to figure out. It started out with a book called The Innovator Spirit. And that was my ability to try to describe what did we do and why did it work? And that's really the first time it became clear to me that it wasn't a process. It was really about the people and their mindset. And then if you get the right mindset and people that believe the right things to allow the right behaviors, you can do these amazing things. And if you don't, you have no chance. And so that's kind of where it started. And as I was working on the book, you know, in collaboration with Marquette, it was like, you know, we can keep going with this idea. And so it led to the Innovator in Residence role and the idea of starting a podcast to talk about not just my story, but you know, innovation's happening all the time. So much we think of it as a tech sector thing. Innovation happens in nonprofits. It happens in just about every industry. The people that survive, it's happened in radio, right? If you don't innovate, you're not relevant anymore. And honestly, it's happening in higher education. And so for me, this is this great opportunity to take these ideas, and Marquette's like a living laboratory, whether it be with the students, with the faculty, and thinking about higher ed. And then the third piece is really, how do we bring it to Milwaukee and business people? We have this incredible city here that if you look at the most famous companies, they're all started by innovators. But most of them were started 100 years ago. And so they're faced with this choice. Are we going to change and keep going? And hopefully sharing these ideas, we can kind of create that next generation of innovative leaders.
So do you teach a class in innovation? Do you coach students who come to you? What is your day-to-day role with students at Marquette?
So I spend part-time helping out with a course that's part of our Excellence in Leadership program, where we actually take students through a 3-year program, undergrads, and we teach them about leading themselves, leading with others, and then the third year is leading innovation. And that's really where I get involved. And we're actually using both principles we found on the outside, but from the book. I'm a guest lecturer in that. I'm not the primary teacher. I'm learning, frankly, how to be more of a teacher than an executive. But I get to share my ideas with them. And honestly, their questions back keep me going. This isn't like an end point. Like this, for me, they've created this laboratory to keep testing my ideas. And so when I wrote my book, I had written a chapter about Thomas Edison and his role in innovation. And I was talking about it in class one day before it was finished. And I had a student challenge me saying, Edison's not a great innovator. Tesla was the innovator. And I said, I really don't know if I agree with you or not. But I went back, researched it, and actually changed the book because of it. So that's kind of my role with students. Then on the other side, you know, Marquette's sitting there and has these people thinking about this every day. But there's not an obvious connection for the companies and industry to talk there. And because my role's not exactly defined, I find myself taking 2 or 3 meetings a week, both inside and outside the universities, with people just saying, can you help us think about this?
Private sector firms, you mean?
Yes, absolutely.
So you're hoping to get some of these student ideas or some of the students into these companies eventually, right?
Yes, and it helps students start their own companies. And then the third piece is really help companies think about innovation differently. So if you work for a large company here, anywhere around the country, if you've had success, you've been promoted because of your ability to take on a task, deliver that task,
on time, on budget, and get the next one. And while those are great skills, those are really management skills, innovation is more of a leadership concept, which is quite different. And so what I'm trying to do with these companies is make them realize that if you expect your team that's all been built and promoted in this environment of following rules and delivering on goals to do things kind of outside the box, that's not going to happen. And so part of one of our ideas is, can we get these companies to bring some of their employees to Marquette? Let's do something together. And it's not because we have better ideas. We can create an environment where we can teach them that it's okay to push the boundaries, where they're not this reinforcement that you have to stay on track, you have to follow the schedule. We give them a chance to kind of test the limits and test failure and test this idea of risk so that once you learn that, you can go back. Because I think the thing we all forget is behaviors are a function of our beliefs, and beliefs are actually learned. So I can tell you what to do, but until you go through and experience it, and typically until you experience failing and surviving at it, you can't do it. And so we have to create an environment to do that. And if you live in a company that's only rewarding success, you can't possibly know what it's like to fail and persevere and to kind of keep being able to move forward.
So you talked a little bit about the companies that have been here 100 years. Do you see the innovative spirit growing in Milwaukee, at least slowly?
I see it starting. You know, I live primarily in Raleigh-Durham. That's where Cree was based. And 20 years ago, I came from Silicon Valley, and you'd say there was no startup entrepreneurial culture other than Cree and a few other companies. Today, there's this healthy environment. So one, I would caution people, it takes time, but I see the beginnings. And part of it is people that want to do this, right? I meet, especially I would say there is a younger professional out there that has this desire to do something different. They want to do what hasn't been done before. It starts there. I think we see some of the programs popping up around the city. What I don't think we have yet is really kind of an ecosystem approach. There's a lot of independent ideas. When this starts to work, it's these ideas become more connected. So the cool stuff that's happening at the Commons and the interesting things that might be happening at Startup Milwaukee are also connected to what's going on at MSOE and Marquette, that they're more integrated. And I think we're seeing the beginnings of that, but we really need an ecosystem, and because that's what it takes to get this momentum building and frankly, some success. You know, you have a few successful companies, they create more entrepreneurs and it builds over time. And I think that's one of the things we have to be aware of. But I think there's a desire, there's a need and a desire and an interest to make this happen. So yeah, I think it's going to happen.
Well, you talk about it, Marquette trying to broaden access to more students maybe that haven't had access to this line of thinking or effort before. Can you talk about that and then how that might help the ecosystem you'd like to see created? If you get a broader number of folks into an ecosystem, maybe that grows?
Absolutely. I mean, some of this is just you don't know what you don't know. If you think about these programs, you know, so many things we do with students in the high school areas are if you grow up in an inner city, going to an inner city high school, and you don't have a lot of connection with engineers and doctors, it's pretty hard to relate to that. Well, if you've never interacted with engineers or entrepreneurs or business people that really did just quit their good job and move across country to join a startup with a small family, and you say, well, they say, why would you do that? You said, well, I was more afraid of missing out on the opportunity of what could have been than what I had. People need role models. They need to believe these things are possible. So yeah, I think we're giving them access to the ideas and what's possible. And I think that's the way this thing starts.
Chuck Svoboda is Marquette University's innovator in residence. He spoke with WUWM's innovation reporter, Chuck Hornbach. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.